Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So imagine for a second that you are managing a vast wildlife reserve.
Yeah, you're out there on the front lines of global conservation, basically trying to save a highly vulnerable species from a rapidly changing climate.
Exactly. The stakes literally could not be higher. It is a battle against extinction. And, well, you only have a limited budget to figure out if your population is actually going to survive.
Right. It's an incredibly high-pressure scenario. And, I mean, for the last 50 years or so, the standard scientific playbook for someone in your position has been remarkably consistent.
You take a sample of the species DNA, you run it through a sequencer, and you look at the results. You are essentially looking for the spelling differences in their genetic code across the whole population.
Because the foundational assumption we have all been operating under is pretty simple. More DNA variety equals a better chance for that species to adapt, evolve, and survive the changing environment.
Right, so you see a lot of spelling differences, and you breathe a sigh of relief. But what if that global standard is actually a mirage?
Yeah, what happens to global conservation if the DNA diversity we so carefully measure and base our policies on has almost zero connection to a species' actual physical ability to evolve?
Okay, let's unpack this, because this fundamentally changes everything.
It really does. Today, we celebrate the work of KDL Labs and Jared D. Hadfield, and their massive collaborative team across the University of Edinburgh, University of Sussex, University of Groningen, and University of Exeter.
They have advanced our understanding of conservation genetics and adaptive potential in a huge way. I mean, their research, published in 2026 in PNAS, essentially takes a sledgehammer to this 50-year-old assumption.
A very data-heavy sledgehammer, yeah. Mm-hmm. But to really understand the scale of what this team has uncovered, we need to talk about the history and the immense global stakes of this problem.
Right, because the holy grail in conservation is something called adaptive potential. Basically, it's the capacity of a population to avoid going extinct by adapting to environmental changes.
And this isn't just an abstract academic concept discussed in university seminars, you know?
Yeah.
Adaptive potential is a top-tier global conservation priority.
It's deeply ingrained in international policy, isn't it? Like 196 countries committed to maintaining genetic diversity to safeguard this exact potential.
Exactly. It was a critical target of the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework. The entire world agreed that we have to preserve genetic variation to save these species.
So the goal is totally clear. But the method of tracking that goal seems to be where things get, well, murky.
Very murky. Because the true actual measure of a species' adaptive potential is something called additive genetic variance.
Additive genetic variance, which is basically the heritable variation in the actual physical traits that influence survival and reproduction, right? The things that matter in the real world.
Precisely. If the climate gets hotter, does the population have the heritable variants in their physiology to tolerate that heat? Or can their beaks change shape to crack different seeds if their primary food source dies out?
But measuring that directly in wild or endangered species seems nearly impossible. You'd need fitness measures for a huge number of known relatives over multiple generations.
You really would. You just can't do that for a rare leopard or a threatened bird species roaming across an entire continent.
You cannot, which is why scientists needed a proxy.
Exactly. Because they couldn't easily measure the real physical trait variants, they started using molecular genetic diversity like nucleotide diversity, which is literally just counting the raw differences in the DNA sequence as a stand-in.
The assumption being that the two scaled perfectly together.
Right. They assumed the proxy and the reality were a one-to-one match.
It is kind of like trying to predict how good a chef is simply by counting the sheer number of random ingredients they have in their pantry.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, without ever checking if any of those ingredients actually taste good together or form a cohesive recipe. You are just assuming that a giant pantry automatically guarantees a Michelin star meal.
That is a great way to conceptualize it. We have literally been counting the ingredients for decades. But nobody had actually been able to prove that having a diverse pantry means the chef can actually cook the specific dish needed to survive a sudden menu change.
Until this study. Because if you want to test a 50-year-old paradigm that the entire globe relies on, you cannot just look at a few fruit flies in a lab.
No, definitely not. You need an overwhelming amount of data to prove the pantry doesn't match the cooking. And what's fascinating here is the unprecedented scale and rigor of their methodology.
So what did they actually look at?
To figure out if nucleotide diversity actually predicts true adaptive potential, the team collated a massive globe-spanning data set. We're talking about 2,113 published estimates of quantitative genetic variation.
Wow. And this spanned, what, 193 eukaryotic species? Everything from plants to birds to mammals?
Exactly. They synthesized molecular data and physical trait data on a global cross-species scale for the very first time.
But I imagine comparing a plant's ability to evolve with a mammal's ability to evolve requires some serious mathematical heavy lifting. You can't just use standard metrics, right?
No, you can't. And that is where the team made a very innovative, critical choice. In the past, scientists often looked at a metric called heritability to compare species.
Okay, heritability.
But heritability is famously flawed for this kind of cross-species comparison because it is variant standardized.
Meaning it gets confused by the environment. Like if an animal is just having a highly successful year because of unusually great weather, heritability might capture that environmental noise and give you a distorted picture of their genetics.
Precisely. If you are looking at a trait in a wild population experiencing a very noisy, chaotic environment, the heritability estimate might look artificially low.
Even if the underlying genetic potential is absolutely there.
Exactly. So instead of heritability, the researchers focused on a metric called evolvability.
Evolvability. How does that strip away the environmental noise?
Well, evolvability is mean standardized variance. Rather than looking at the total noise, it quantifies the maximum proportional change in a trait mean per generation.
Under a standardized strength of selection.
Yeah. Yes. It looks purely at the trait itself and mathematically calculates how much that specific trait can shift in one generation. It completely avoids the environmental confounding factor,
making it a much purer measure of true adaptive potential.
Exactly. And to make sure they were comparing apples to apples across this massive tree of life, they also used Bayesian linear mixed models.
Bayesian models? That sounds intense. What did that help them do?
It allowed them to control for evolutionary relationships known as phylogeny. Because obviously, two closely related bird species might share similar traits just because they are cousins.
Oh, right. Not necessarily because of their underlying genetic diversity.
Exactly. The Bayesian models also allowed them to control for differences in how the original data was estimated by different scientists over the years in those 2,000 plus studies.
So they essentially cleared away all the statistical noise and family resemblances.
Yes, so they could look directly at the raw relationship. Does the DNA diversity we measure predict the evolvability the species actually has?
Okay, let's get into what they found when all that noise was cleared away. Because first off, there's a technical baseline here, right?
Right.
For decades, conservationists used an older type of DNA marker called microsatellites. But recently, we upgraded to measuring nucleotide diversity. You would naturally assume these two rulers for measuring genetic variety would at least agree with each other.
I mean, it would be a major problem if they didn't.
Well, they don't. The researchers found that microsatellite diversity and nucleotide diversity don't even significantly correlate with each other across the 57 species where they had data for both.
That is the first massive red flag. If our two main instruments for measuring molecular diversity are telling us completely different stories about the same populations, well, the foundation is already shaking.
Yeah, big time. But the real structural collapse comes when they looked at how well nucleotide diversity predicts evolvability.
This is the core of it.
Imagine being that conservationist we talked about at the beginning. You've spent a massive chunk of your budget sequencing a leopard population. You get a high nucleotide diversity score, and you think they are safe to adapt.
But statistically, the researchers found that nucleotide diversity explains a mere 1.1% of the interspecific differences in evolvability.
1.1%.
It is practically zero. The proxy is entirely disconnected from the reality of the physical traits.
That is staggering.
To put that in perspective, the researchers calculated what would happen if you were to mathematically double a species' nucleotide diversity.
If the 50-year-old assumption was right, you would expect a massive proportional leap in their adaptive potential, right?
Exactly. But the data shows that doubling nucleotide diversity only corresponds to an 11.7% increase in evolvability.
Now, if you're listening to this and thinking, well, maybe they just looked at the wrong parts of the DNA. You aren't alone. I've got the exact same thing.
Oh, totally.
What if we ignore all the random neutral DNA that doesn't code for anything and just look at the DNA that actually builds the animal, you know, the functional variation?
The researchers anticipated that exact skepticism. They tested it by looking at the ratio of non-synonymous to synonymous mutations.
To clarify, non-synonymous mutations actually swap out the building blocks of a protein, altering how it functions, while synonymous ones are silent and don't change the protein at all.
Right, so they zoomed in specifically on the mutations actually changing the proteins.
And surely that must have yielded a stronger connection. I mean, it's the functional stuff.
The prediction power remained essentially zero. In fact, it was slightly worse. Doubling that functional variation only increased evolvability by 1.0%.
Wait, if the relationship isn't one-to-one, why did the scientific community ever think it was? What does the underlying math actually say? Because you don't just build global frameworks, write textbooks, and spend millions of conservation dollars based on a total guess.
It is a brilliant question, and the researchers address this by diving into the theoretical models that birthed this assumption in the first place.
Okay, so where did we go wrong, theoretically?
It turns out, a perfect one-to-one relationship between molecular genetic diversity and additive genetic variance only exists on paper under very strict and, frankly, unrealistic conditions.
Unrealistic how?
It only exists for physical traits that are strictly 100% neutral.
Meaning traits that nature doesn't care about at all. Traits that offer zero advantage or disadvantage to survival or reproduction.
Exactly. Which contradicts the entire premise of adaptive potential.
Yeah.
The traits that actually matter for survival, the ones that will save a species from a shifting climate, are not neutral.
Right.
In reality, physical traits are under what we call stabilizing selection.
Stabilizing selection. So if nature is aggressively pruning away any physical trait that isn't helping an organism survive right this second, it means the genetic variance we are looking at is heavily biased.
Very much so. Think about how stabilizing selection operates in the wild. If you have a trait that is highly beneficial right now, it sweeps through the population and becomes fixed. Everyone gets it.
And if you have a trait that is harmful right now,
selection weeds it out. Those individuals simply don't survive to pass it on.
Which means the visible genetic diversity we measure when we sequence a genome, that nucleotide diversity is being driven by completely different forces than the genetic variance of the physical traits.
Yes. The paper highlights that nucleotide diversity is largely driven by sheer population size and the baseline mutation rate.
So if you have a huge population, you will naturally accumulate a vast amount of neutral spelling differences in the DNA simply because there are more individuals reproducing and mutating.
Exactly.
So the pantry is full of random ingredients, mostly because you have a really big kitchen, your population size.
Right. But because stabilizing selection is clamping down on the actual physical traits, that huge pool of neutral DNA variety is completely decoupled from the specific functional traits the animal needs to evolve.
Wow. The math proves that the forces driving DNA sequence variety and the forces driving physical trait evolvability are operating on completely different tracks. One is dictated by population size, the other by the immediate pressures of survival.
Yes. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the clinical and policy implications are profound and urgent. The current paradigm is actively risking misinforming conservation management.
We can no longer rely on simple molecular proxies to tell us if a species can survive climate change, habitat loss, or novel diseases.
We really can't. Because right now, that conservation manager might sequence a population, see high nucleotide diversity, and mistakenly think, great, they have high adaptive potential, we can focus our limited funds on a different reserve.
But statistically, that population might actually have very low evolvability and be entirely unprepared for a heat wave.
It's exactly. Or, conversely, a population with low nucleotide diversity might be written off as doomed and abandoned when they actually have the necessary trait variants to survive.
That is terrifying.
It is. And this leads to what is perhaps the most mind-bending theoretical insight of the entire paper. It is a paradoxical trade-off regarding how adaptation actually works.
Okay, lay it on me.
We just talked about how stabilizing selection keeps slightly harmful or deleterious variants at very low frequencies in the current environment.
It's almost like keeping a bulky, heavy winter coat in your closet while you live in the desert. Right now, it's just taking up space and weighing you down. It's a slight disadvantage, a flaw in your current setup.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
But environments change. And when they do, the optimal phenotype changes. The specific genetic variants that might save a species in a future environment, like an impending ice age, are highly likely to be those exact same variants that are slightly harmful in the current desert environment.
Oh, wow. So the second that ice age hits, the individuals who held on to that annoying, flawed winter coat are the only ones who survive.
Yes. The genetic variants that are essentially mistakes or flaws today are the very variants that could be beneficial tomorrow.
This means that the genetic baggage, or the mutation load a species carries today, the stuff that currently lowers their fitness slightly and is actively targeted by stabilizing selection, might actually be their evolutionary salvation tomorrow.
It is a massive paradigm shift. It completely flips how we think about a healthy genome.
Yeah, we usually think of a healthy population as one that has purged all its bad mutations and is perfectly adapted to its surroundings. But if they purge everything that isn't perfect for today, they have no winter coats left in the closet to help them survive tomorrow.
Right, and it highlights a critical limitation moving forward. The authors make it very clear that simply getting better or more precise DNA sequence estimates won't fix this problem.
Because the problem isn't that our sequencers are broken, the technology is phenomenal.
Exactly. The problem is that they are accurately measuring the wrong thing. We are accurately measuring nucleotide diversity, but we've definitively proven it doesn't predict evolvability. So getting a higher resolution picture of the wrong proxy doesn't help the conservation manager.
So where do we go from here? I mean, what are the actual next steps for conservationists out in the field who need to know if a species is going to survive?
The paper suggests that future strategies are going to require a lot more sophistication. We may need to rely on complex predictions based on genomic annotation.
Meaning we have to move beyond just counting overall diversity and actually start understanding what specific genes do.
Yes, how they interact, and how those networks of genes map to physical traits.
Which is infinitely more difficult and resource-intensive than just running a DNA sample through a machine and getting a diversity score.
It is a monumental task. Furthermore, conservationists and policymakers are going to have to critically rethink how genetic data is applied to global tools like the IUCN Red List.
Because there has been a big, well-intentioned push to include genetic data in these extinction risk assessments, right?
Right. But if we are using nucleotide diversity to assess adaptive potential for those lists, this study shows we might be making fundamentally flawed categorizations.
Potentially allocating resources to the wrong species.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? If we distill this entire deep dive down, despite its foundational role in global conservation policies for half a century, simple molecular genetic diversity does not reliably predict a species' short-term capacity to adapt to environmental changes.
It just doesn't.
To truly safeguard the evolutionary resilience of vulnerable populations, science and policy must urgently move beyond basic DNA sequence variation.
We have to stop just looking in the pantry and counting the ingredients and start figuring out how the chef actually cooks. We need new frameworks, new metrics, and a willingness to abandon a convenient proxy that the data shows simply doesn't work.
It leaves us with a profound shift in perspective. What does this mean for how we define a healthy population if the genetic flaws of today are the evolutionary lifelines of tomorrow?
It's something the entire field is going to have to grapple with.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Tiny letters, sharp and clean. We counted all the differences, called it room to grow. But the future wouldn't line up in a row. 'Cause change don't ride on one simple score. It's not a mirror, it's something more. Mutation whispers, selection holds, and drift just turns the story cold. Don't tell me life is safe, because the barcode shows. Barely moves the line. Adaptation's not a number you can oversimplify. So read the traits, feel the ground, hear the living roar. If we want tomorrow, we need more than a number. can't break free. Evolvability bends under hidden rules, rates and restraints in stabilizing schools. Microsatellite sparks, nucleotide waves, two different maps that don't point to the same. Hold up, the heartbeat's not just a code. Measure what matters in the wild's hard road. A shallow slope in a noisy sky says, don't bet the species on a single proxy tonight. Build a plan with function, with fitness, with care. Not just a scatter plot hanging in the air. Don't tell me life is safe, because the barcode shines. A high pay can't promise brighter times. Doubling the signal, barely moving.